The Last Human Voice. Short talks. What am I worth?
I'm Dr. Mathilde Pavy. I'm a lawyer and an expert in intellectual property law, ethics and new technologies.
I'm Marcus Hutton, actor, voice artist and chair of the Equity Audio Committee.
And I'm Annette Rizzo, voice artist and union activist on a steep learning curve.
In previous episodes, we've discussed a range of topics around a central theme of AI and performers' rights. We've gone into a lot of detail and we've invited guests to share their own experiences and expertise.
Now, we thought we'd try something a little different this time and distill some of our most frequently asked questions into a series of shorter talks. We aimed for 10 minutes, but they may be a little longer. We'll see how we do with that.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the sayings that you hear a lot amongst artists and probably anybody who's self-employed and has to negotiate their own rates is know your worth, which is all very well. But how do you put a specific financial figure on what you do? Now, Marcus, you have been doing this job even longer than I have. So I'm going to start by going to you. How do you know what you're worth?
Well, yeah, I'm not sure if I ever really liked this know your worth phrase, because I think it's pretty subjective. And I think over the years, I've seen performers, you know, undervalue themselves and sometimes massively overvalue themselves. And I think both of those things can be detrimental. So it's a really fine art kind of finding something in the middle. But for me, my general negotiating practice, I suppose, if there's not an agent doing it for me, is I'm supposed to present a case for a payment that's fair for what's being offered, and, you know, to provide a sort of digestible rationale for that and be upfront and clear. I think if you're sort of clear at the front, businesslike, that can really help. And also experience sort of teaches you to look out for what the job is, what its reach will be. I mean, how long am I going to be associated with this output? You know, what's the audience? How big will that audience be? And to know how long it'll actually take to record or film something. And in the end, to weigh up who I'm negotiating with. I mean, that's a thing. You have to build trust with people quite quickly. And I think you develop a kind of second sense for, is this person, you know, stringing me along, or are they asking for more than I can kind of give for their budget or whatever it is? So,
yeah, are they going to be trouble?
Yeah, are they going to be trouble? Exactly. It's relational.
You get the sense they want to ask for everything for nothing in return. Can you do, you know, can you do a million things? You've got £5 in the budget.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, and I find, I think this is probably true for a lot of people who've been doing it for a while, but, you know, when clients are wholly price focused, that's usually what sets off alarm bells for me. You know, and you've got to have a base level and a set of terms that you won't drop below. So I think it's always about context. It's about kind of reading the room, if you like. That's what experience teaches you, I think. And it's not an exact science at all. But I'd say generally, the more you know about the market, the more you know about industry practices, the easier it is to negotiate. You know, I would always say that to sort of younger folk or people who studying the voiceover sector particularly, and, you know, learn the history, understand why you get paid what you get paid. There's lots of good resources out there. You know, there's lots of good stuff you can look up, Equity, or there are plenty of other forums and things you can find stuff out from.
Talk to old folks like us.
Yes, talk to old folks like us, exactly. But, you know, my main concern as a performer is that I'm doing a good job. You know, I want the worst job that I do, that, you know, I want my lowest bar to be professional and good quality. And I, you know, and I always really would like to surpass expectations. So it's not just about money. But, you know, I sort of find myself thinking these days about whether I'm getting myself into something which could be a miserable experience. I mean, that's more true as an actor, you know, than as a voiceover, because the work's shorter as a voiceover. But if something's kind of on the table that's going to take up a few months of my time, I'm just getting old, basically. You know, I did my time. I did my theatre and education tours in the middle of winter, jumping in and out of vans, you know, two shows a day, plays that kids don't want to watch.
You probably loved it at the time, though, didn't you? You probably had, you know, that kind of thing has its own fun and glamour when you're 20.
Yeah, that was fine when I was 22, 23. But I just, you know, I just don't have the energy for that. So on longer jobs, I sort of look at something and go, you know, is this going to be something that's going to be kind of fun, or is going to be sort of worthwhile? So, I mean, you know, it's interesting, isn't it? We talk about these things sort of vaguely. There is a legal definition, which is equitable remuneration, and that's a legal right in many jurisdictions. And I don't know what you think, Mathilde, but I sort of take that to mean fair payment for the exploitation of a performance in a public-facing work. And there are rules you can...
Hang on, say it again. Say it again more slowly.
Sorry. Equitable remuneration is a legal phase for... I think it basically... I mean, Mathilde can explain, but I think it means it's fair payment for the exploitation of the work that you're doing. And... from what I understand, you know, judges will look at sort of market practice and history. Is that right, Mathilde?
That's right. So I think going back to, you know, getting paid and negotiations and linking that to equitable remuneration, we need to separate payment you receive for your services, for time spent on set, on the stage, in the recording studio, and remuneration for the exploitation of your intellectual property. So if you're a performer working in sound, that would often be the exploitation of the sound recording that carries your performance. And that's the second category, the exploitation of the intellectual property that equitable remuneration rights attach to, as opposed to fair pay for your time, your labor, if you'd like to put it like that. So as a lawyer, that's always how I approach it. When I look at the pay in a performer's contract, I look at how much is being paid for prepping, showing up, doing the job, physically being there, physically bring your skill set, bring yourself to the performing space, whatever that may be, and then separately how much is being paid for the transfer of the performer's intellectual property right to the person that's going to exploit the intellectual property. And often that's the producer, but that could also be other companies and intermediaries, whether it's a licensing agreement or an assignment. Now, when you assign your rights, the law gives you added protection so that when you transfer those rights, you receive a right to be paid fairly for that. And what equitable means is, as far as we understand today, based on the law and the case law we've got, is that the payment you receive needs to be proportionate to the money made by the exploitation of the intellectual property. And that was introduced into the law because we realized that this wasn't happening naturally through just current industry practice or market practice, even though that was the logic and the theory of intellectual property rights all along. We realized that in practice, performers were not getting paid a fair amount or a proportion of the exploitation of the work through royalties or residuals, depending on the sector they're in. So the legislator started introducing added protections here and there. Now, the problem is that equitable remuneration is a little bit technical and more recent as a right and a little bit patchy. It's been introduced for certain types of exploitation, mainly for sound recordings, which is good news for voiceovers because you work in sound recordings primarily.
Hey.
But I think it makes this right a little bit more obscure than your typical standard performer's rights or even performer's more rights. And this is sort of industry needed to catch on this new right, which was recently further expanded by the copyright directive. So many more EU member states will have a strong culture very soon, I hope, of equitable remuneration, which we'll hope will flow to other countries and other jurisdictions in the positive direction for performers.
It's also true of the Beijing Treaty, isn't it? The Beijing Treaty has also extended these rights to audiovisual performances as opposed to just audio performances.
So the Beijing Treaty gives the option to introduce an exclusive right that you can bargain or have a compulsory license for which you have equitable remuneration, if my memory serves me. So in the UK, UK law has been deemed to already implement that with the setup it's got. So I think the EU copyright directive is a step further into that equitable remuneration right practice, if you'd like.
So here in the UK, so just to get it straight, the EU copyright directive that you've mentioned, that covers European, well, all the countries in the EU, obviously. We are not part of it because we left the EU, but a lot of the work we do does actually get broadcast or, you know, is used in the EU. So we still have access to that right. We can still claim that right because it's in the country of broadcast or the country of use. The Beijing Treaty is much broader, obviously, globally. The UK is part of it, but we haven't completely finished the process of putting that into law, have we?
That's right. So the UK has left the EU after the directive was approved by the EU, but before it was implemented. So it means that we won't see a direct transplant of what the copyright directive provides under UK law, which is a great shame, I think, because that would have made our lives so much easier. And then current understanding is that the EU directive and its rights will apply wherever the work is exploited. So it could flow to performers, or it could end up benefiting performers outside the EU, although that's a point that is sometimes debated. We may have further cases that will confirm that. So yes, maybe, which is never helpful for a short answer. And the Beijing Treaty, most of its provisions are already enacted under UK law, and the UK is looking at doing top-ups here and there to make sure everything's shipshape Bristol fashion. So,
okay, so we are further down the line then with the Beijing Treaty. So here's the nuts and bolts then, is how do I apply that? I can say to a prospective employer, I have the right of equitable remuneration, and the EU Copyright Directive says this and the Beijing Treaty says that. But is that actually realistically something I can take to an employer? And how do I actually use that in my day-to-day work?
That's a great question. I mean, really, you can try. I think it goes back to Marcus's advice to put a fair case and a clear breakdown as to how you've come up with this price. I think equitable remuneration means you're going to exploit my work. You're going to generate money. I'm entitled to a fraction of that. I'm not saying the majority money of that. I'm saying a fraction of that. And then explaining that and pointing to the law and saying that's a right you have. Now, is your best shot and is what I would do. The issue you're facing as a performer is that the industry and the culture right now is set on buyout with very low fees and has not yet caught up with what is becoming a legal standard, a minimum legal standard. So you're in that transition period, which can be challenging, but nothing changes unless you try.
Sure. I mean, it's actually one of those things that when Equity did the template contract, which I worked on for a year, those terms and conditions do mention, you know, EU rights and all of that stuff. So that's why I have a set of terms and conditions now, just as a link on my website. It's sort of like, if you want to know more, you can go and read that. The contract's very fair. It just covers what the law is, and it doesn't do it in a sort of in-your-face way. I mean, this is, you know, this is difficult for performers sometimes. It's sort of once you start demanding your rights and sort of shouting about, you know, my entitlement and what I should be paid and everything else, you can start to sound a bit sort of shrill. So I just try and, you know, give it a framework clearly at the beginning and keep the conversation friendly. Because as a performer, I want to focus on the work, not on all this contractual stuff. But at the same time, I'm not going to engage with the job until that's sort of satisfactory for me. You know, I think that's the only way I can sort of do it, you know. But yeah, you've said this many times, Matilda. My desire is to sort of please the client. It's just sort of baked into me somewhere. But I do have to say, you know, and it depends. I mean, that's what I said about context. Context is really important. You know, I mean, I will do something for a mate, perhaps more favorably than I would for somebody that, you know, is a big commercial enterprise. So, yeah.
On top of what you've said, Marcus, the terms and conditions on your website, link in your email. So I've done that too.
Sure.
And I've taken comparatively recently, actually, to starting to, when clients ask for the moon, I have started to lay out options for them. So it's in a friendly way, I'm able to say, here, this is what you can have for this price, and this is why.
Yeah.
And this is what you can have for this price, and this is why. And actually, so far, they've responded quite positively to that. So
yeah, it's a dialogue, you know, a reasonable dialogue.
Yeah, that could be a way to open up that dialogue.
So, as always, we should point out that these discussions are an exploration of the topic we tackle and should not be taken as legal advice.
Oh, well, I hope you found some of that useful. It was a sort of quick insight into our practice after a lot of years of doing this. So we hope you found that useful. If there's another question you'd like us to ask or another issue you'd like us to tackle, then please do let us know.
Instagram or Twitter /X, whatever you want to call it now, search at LHV Podcast and you can ask away or send us a message. Do please give us a follow if you go onto social media. And all that remains to be said is thank you very much for listening to The Last Human Voice.